Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We're going to be going back to the beginning of chapter 4 today. I know that I had skipped into some of the later parts of chapter 4 at the end of last week, but I wanted to come back and talk a little bit more about simpler ionic compounds before we then return to the end of chapter 4. So hopefully over the weekend you all had a chance to read more about chapter 3 and read more about electron configuration. So I just wanted to do a really quick little bit of practice on electron configurations. And so I wanted to see if you all could tell me the configurations for magnesium and for sulfur, which you've got the periodic table over here to your left if you're able to see it from where you're seated. So anybody that wants to, can you tell me the configuration for magnesium? Go ahead. What's the full configuration, though? The whole thing, yes. Right, so what would that electron configuration be? Yes. That's right. 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2, which there's a couple of different ways you can remember the order. There is this way that the book has where it lines up the different types of orbitals and then has this series of diagonal lines that you could use to recreate that if you needed to. But if you remember, I said that this is really related to the format of the periodic table. So remember that the top row is written a little differently than the electron configurations actually occur. Helium really should be over next to hydrogen, because in that first row of the periodic table, the only type of orbital that we do have is the S orbital. An S orbital or S subshell can only hold two electrons, and once you fill those two electrons up, then you move to the next energy level. So over on the left-hand side, and just to remind you, I had divided up the periodic table into these different blocks. And I called them the S, the P, the D, and then down below here is the F block. What those designations mean is it's the type of electron that would be filled last in that area of the periodic table. And if you can remember that, then when you go to row 2 on the left-hand side, those first two columns, you start over again with the S subshell. So since we're on the second level, that's why this symbol starts with 2. And then, again, the S subshell can only hold two electrons in it. Then on the right-hand side of the periodic table, that's the P subshell. The P subshell can hold 6 electrons, and so that gets filled up. And then we move on to the next energy level again. So move on to the next row of the periodic table. And so we get over to where sodium is and magnesium, and those are the last two electrons that would finish out that 3S subshell. So sulfur is going to start out the same way. Every time that we go past to a higher element, we're still going to have the same initial configuration. So this is going to be 1s2, 2s2, 2p6, 3s2. But for sulfur, what will follow after that? 3p4. It's not 3p6 because we don't have enough electrons to totally fill up that subshell. So it's not that automatically P is always 6. It depends on the total number of electrons that we have. Now, I'll get to the elements a little bit lower down the periodic table later on, but we're going to stick to the first 18 up through argon for the moment because it's very relatively easy to come up with their electron configurations. Now, can somebody remind me what valence electrons are? The outermost electrons, which means the outermost shell, not just the outermost subshell. So if I was going to underline the valence electrons in these two elements, it would just be the 3s electrons for magnesium, but it would be the s and the p electrons for sulfur. So magnesium has 2 valence electrons, and then sulfur has 6 valence electrons. And the reason I'm doing this review is to try to explain what kind of charges are these elements going to form normally when they react? So could someone tell me what the charges for magnesium and sulfur will end up being, and can you give me a justification why? Yeah.
Magnesium will be plus 2
mm-hmm.
because it wants to give away 2 electrons.
Right.
And then sulfur will be minus 2 because it wants to get 2 electrons.
And that's because it's easier for magnesium to lose 2 than to gain 6 electrons. Because if you think of it this way, even though the nucleus is positively charged, so maybe you might be able to add another electron into magnesium. Once it's negatively charged, it's hard to bring 2 negatively charged objects together. So if you tried to put 6 negative charges onto magnesium, it's just not favorable. Sulfur, because you get to the point where you fill this octet, it is easier for it to gain 2 electrons than to lose 6. Because if you imagine, if you keep pulling away negative charges, then you make an atom that's more and more positive, and so it gets tougher and tougher to keep pulling those electrons away. So yes, magnesium will go from 0 to a plus 2 charge, and sulfur will go from 0 to a minus 2 charge. Now, one thing that I haven't talked about yet is naming of ions, which you're not going to have to memorize the periodic table. I had to do that back in high school or junior high. But everybody has these electronic devices we carry around now. So other than getting familiar with the elements in the periodic table, I don't really see the usefulness in memorizing the periodic table. But there are a few names that you're going to have to learn, and specifically for ions. So that's why I wanted to cover that today, to give you the time during this week to start working on memorizing those names, because as you might know, we do have an exam coming up next week. So I want to make sure you have the time to learn the names. So naming monatomic ions, which I think I did introduce that term monatomic before. What does that mean? That you only have one atom in the ion. So remember, an ion is something that's charged, and that could be just an individual atom, that could be a molecule, that could be a really huge molecule. So monatomic refers to the fact that it's only one atom that's involved. For cations, in the main group, which if I haven't defined that term enough, precisely enough before, main group elements are the elements in the first 2 columns and the last 6 columns of the periodic table. And the reason they're called the main group elements is they're the elements that normally obey the octet rule because they're in those regions of the periodic table. So because they obey the octet rule, it's very predictable what the ion charges are going to end up being. So just like what we discussed with magnesium and sulfur, the things towards the left-hand side of the periodic table almost always end up forming positive charges because that's the way it's easiest for them to get to the octet. And the things on the right-hand side of the table almost always end up forming negative charges because that's the way it's easiest for them to end up with an octet. So when you have cations, they're in the main group. The names of the cations are identical to the element names. So for example, when you put a plus charge on sodium, this is just called the sodium ion. There's no special name for it. Now, the D block of the periodic table, the 10 columns that are in the middle here, those are what are known as transition elements. And all of them are metals, so they're usually called transition metals. The reason they're called transition metals is they're bridging in between the 2 parts of the main group. And they're elements that don't necessarily follow the octet rule. So it's not really possible to come up with one rule to say what charges will their elements be. For those who are in chemistry, you get to the point where you're familiar with the different elements to know what they tend to do. But from your perspective, if you're just starting to learn chemistry, it's beyond the level of this course to make you all learn what all those different elements do in terms of charges. So, in fact, in your text, there's only one of these elements that it has you learn at all, and that's the only one I'm going to have you learn for the moment, and that's iron, because it is a very common element that shows up in lots of materials. So for cations, of transition elements. And those are the D block elements. Transition elements can form ions, or frequently form ions, of multiple charges. So the more modern way to name those ions is to use a Roman numeral that represents the charge after the name of the element. So to name a specific cation, a Roman numeral is used to specify the charge of the ion. So the example the book gives is iron, where iron tends to form two different kinds of charges, iron plus 2 and iron plus 3. So the way we would name these is to say iron, and then in parentheses, we'd write Roman numeral 2 for the iron that's plus 2 charge. And for iron plus 3, it would simply be called iron 3. So we don't use the Roman numerals for most main group elements because the main group elements almost always follow the octet rule. So as long as you understand the format of the periodic table, and you can count the column that the element's in, you can automatically figure out what charge it's going to form. This is not true of the transition metals, which is why for those we have to use these parentheses with the Roman numerals. Now there is an older system of naming that you'll still see sometimes. Chemical substances, they're not like food products. They don't necessarily go bad over time. Obviously, some do, but a lot don't. And so if you're working in a lab that has really old bottles of chemicals, they might use this older method of naming. And so iron 2 and iron 3 are also called ferrous and ferric. Yes, two R's. And this us and ick ending actually shows up in a lot of the names of ions. So for lead, you end up with plumbus and plumbic. For copper, you end up with cuprous and cupric. We're not going to memorize any of those names because they're not the modern system of naming. But if you ever encounter one of these names, I'll just tell you that the us ending always means a lower charge than the ick ending. So I'm just showing these because they're mentioned in your text, but in this class we'll always name things according to the modern standard of just using these parentheses to show the charge. Now what about anions? So the transition metals and the elements on the left-hand side of the periodic table almost universally only form positive charges. So it tends to only be main group elements that would naturally form anions. So I'll just say anions in the main group. So most anion names, end with ide, I-D-E. So often if you see something that ends in ide, it automatically means something that's negatively charged. Some of the elements, it's easy to come up with their names. So if you have F, which is fluorine, then F minus, which realize that fluorine is one column away from being on the very right of the periodic table. So it's one electron away from being in octet configuration. So fluorine tends to make a negative one charge. So it goes from fluorine to be calling fluoride. Similarly, if you have Cl, which is chlorine, it becomes chloride. So all of the elements in that second to last column work the same way. Bromine becomes bromide. Iodine becomes iodide. So that's relatively straightforward. Some of the other elements, though, their names change a bit. And I guess it's just from historical precedents how we came up with these names. So O for oxygen becomes O minus 2, which is oxide, not oxygenide. It's oxide. Nitrogen becomes N negative 3, which is nitride. Sulfur, which in the U.S., the standard spelling is to use an F. You'll see it with a PH sometimes, but the standard way to do it is with an F. Sulfur is in the same column as oxygen, so it'll also form a negative 2 ion, and it becomes sulfide. Let's see if there's any other common ones that you need to know. Oh, yes. Phosphorus. Becomes negative 3 charge, and it'll be phosphide. So those four, oxide, nitride, sulfide, phosphide, they're the ones that you might have to memorize, and they're elements that occur biologically even, so they're important enough that, yes, you need to memorize those ion names. So this is the way we come up with monatomic cation and anion names. Now, since sodium ion and sodium metal have the same name, you have to know how the name's being used to recognize if we're talking about the element sodium or if we're talking about a substance like sodium chloride. In sodium chloride, it's sodium ion that's going to be present. But if I say sodium metal, that means it's neutral sodium. And the ion and the element have very, very different properties from each other. Sodium chloride, when you have sodium ions floating around in water, which are mostly unreactive in water alone. If you take sodium metal and throw it in water, that could potentially cause an explosion because sodium will very rapidly react with water. One of the byproducts you get is hydrogen gas. You'll also get a lot of heat. So if you build up hydrogen gas and heat, the two together is what can cause an explosion. Same thing with chlorine versus chloride or fluoride. Fluoride is something they put in toothpaste. And chloride is something that's often floating around in water. They may react with other molecules, but in water it's pretty much unreactive. But fluorine as a gas is incredibly hazardous. If you aim a stream of fluorine gas at a piece of paper, it'll make that paper just automatically ignite, turn into a huge fireball, because fluorine's terribly reactive. But fluoride is a different creature. So I'm just making the distinction between how the elements behave and then how the ions behave. So now that we've got ions, what about naming ionic compounds. And about writing their formulas. So even though I've titled this Naming Ionic Compounds, I should say this. When writing the formulas for ionic compounds, charge is always balanced. It's not possible to take a bottle and just fill it up with sodium ions, because all of that positive charge would be incredibly unfavorable to keep trapped next to each other. Same thing, it's not possible to have a bottle of just chloride, negative ions. You always have negative and positive that balance each other out somehow. So when you write out a simple ionic formula, you have to have enough of each anion or cation that you're going to end up with a neutral substance. So when you have something like sodium that combines with chlorine, sodium tends to be plus one. Chlorine, based off its position of periodic table, makes chloride, which is minus one. Since you have one plus charge and one minus charge, you only need one of each atom to come together to make a neutral formula. And when we name the compound, we just name cation first, anion second. So this is sodium chloride. So just as a reminder, cation, then anion. We don't need any parentheses on the sodium because it's a main group element. What if we wanted to make calcium chloride? Well, calcium, what would its charge normally be?
Positive 2.
And we already know that chlorine makes a negative 1 charge. So if we put the two together, we need two chlorines to balance out the calcium. And the way we do that is to write the number underneath on the right-hand side of the element. So backing up a couple lectures, you might remember when we talked about atomic symbols, I said there's different numbers that you can put in different corners of the symbol. So down on the lower right-hand side, that tells you how many of that particular element that you have. So this would be called calcium chloride. Now, it's not called something like calcium dichloride. You're going to see later on that naming certain other types of compounds, we use some prefixes to say how many atoms that we have when we make the names. But because chloride is automatically negative 1, because calcium automatically plus 2, as long as you know that, then you don't need to say anything more in the name, because a chemist would know, oh, that's right, we need two chlorines to balance out that charge for the calcium. What if I had something like aluminum oxide? Which, so those of you who may be from outside the U.S., yes, the word is aluminium. That's even the official name of the element. We just say it differently over here and spell it differently. We say aluminum, but most of the rest of the planet says it aluminium. So aluminum oxide, how would I write that formula out? Yes?
Al2 on the bottom and O3.
That's right. Which, to do it step by step, for those of you who haven't done this at all before, I'm showing the ions and their charges just to emphasize what those charges should be. So aluminum's in the third main group column. We ignore the transition metals. So since aluminum's in the third column, that means it's going to have 3 valence electrons, and that's why it would normally form a plus 3 charge. Oxygen, we've already seen, is going to be a negative 2 charge. And when we put the two together, the charges have to balance. So if we take 2 aluminums, that'll give us a total of plus 6. If we take 3 oxides, that'll give us a total of minus 6. So you put the two together, that balances out. Now notice that even though on the ions I always put charges, when you're writing the formula of a compound, you don't include the charges there. So we don't write aluminum plus 3 with the 2 on the bottom, oxygen negative 2 with the 3. You leave the charges out when you're writing a compound's formula. Last example I'll do is this. If I have iron, and let's say that I have iron with nitrogen, what would the name of this compound be? Yeah.
We would have to know which iron it is.
That's right. We have to know, is it iron 2 or iron 3, which we can tell because of the nitrogen. Nitrogen, based where it's on the periodic table, what charge would it want to be? Negative 3 charge. So the very right-hand side of the periodic table, I think we learned about the term group. Even though I didn't talk much about it yet, there's a little bit of chapter 3 left over that I still got to review. So the different columns of the periodic table have names. And the last column are called the noble gases. And the reason they're called that is they're all gases. And the reason they're called noble is because they don't react. So it's like they're better than everybody else. That's where the term noble comes from. So the reason they don't tend to react is because they already have octet configurations. So they don't normally like to gain or lose electrons. It is possible to make compounds out of them. There have been created substances that include the noble gases as part of a compound. Normal behavior is they don't react. One column over, the halogens. That term halogen means salt maker. So there tend to be negative 1. Oxygen's column negative 2. Nitrogen, because it's one more way, it tends to be negative 3. So if you have nitrogen, which is negative 3 charge, and we know that we always write formulas as neutral formulas, that means iron's going to have to be plus 3 charge. And so we know that this name is going to be iron 3 nitride. Yes? You could also say ferric nitride, yes, to use the older naming system, yes. So does anyone have any questions about coming up with the ion charges or the ion names or putting the ions together? Yes. So carbon's an odd case. Carbon, when it forms compounds, it technically can have charges that range from everything from negative 4 to plus 4. So most carbon-containing compounds, we have a completely separate naming system for it that we're barely going to touch on in this class. So normally you won't have to worry about carbon. Yeah. So some people get taught to write the plus sign first. Some people get taught to write it afterwards. Whichever way you're more comfortable with, they're both accepted. And as you notice, and I might have mentioned this before, but now we're starting to see some examples. When I have a negative 1 or a positive 1, I tend to leave the number 1 out. Some people are fussy about keeping the number in. So whichever way you want to do it is fine with me. Just realize if you do take another chemistry class, someone might have a different way that they do it. Whether you include it or not, though, it's both of them are common. Okay, so we got through the monatomic ions. Now, I had already started showing you a little bit about polyatomic ions. And there is a handful of these that you do need to memorize, and I'm going to follow the book here to make sure that I don't give you extra ones to memorize. And the best way to do this is probably to make flashcards. I mean, if any of you have ever learned foreign languages before, you might have done the same thing. You get your vocab words, you get a set of cards, and you go through them until you memorized them. Same thing you're going to have to do with these ion names. And I know you might be thinking, wait, why do I have to learn these names if I could just look them up? Well, it's kind of like, yes, in a foreign language, you could always use a translation device, but how well are you going to be able to operate in that language then? Similar to chemistry, if we start seeing lots of chemical formulas and you have to be able to have some familiarity with chemical formulas, how could you get very far unless you memorize the things that are so common that you use them all the time? So there is a handful, a little bit more than a dozen of ions that you really just need to learn. And I strongly suggest that you do practice because naming of compounds will be one of the things on the exam. And I know that a lot of people don't like doing the memorization work, they don't like doing the naming, but then that means they always get zinged on the exam due to that nomenclature, that naming. If you do practice it, it ends up something that doesn't end up being very difficult. So they're easy points to get as long as you're willing to do the work. So let me go ahead and list out the ones that you're going to need to know. The part that makes it difficult at first is that when you see these ions, you won't have any intuitive sense why do they have the charges that they do. So for example, these two nitrogen-containing ions, they both end up being negatively charged. There is a way to explain that, and I started showing that last time when I did Lewis dot structures. But that requires really understanding the structures, which you'll get as we keep doing some practice. But at first, you're just going to have to rely on memorization. So these are what are known as oxoions. That's not a term I'm going to make you memorize yet, but that means ions that have oxygen as part of their formula. So the most common endings, the way that the names end, are they end in ate or ite. So this first one is called nitrate, and the next one is called nitrite. Now, ate does not necessarily mean three oxygens. Ite does not necessarily mean two. But what's always true is that the compound that ends in ite has one less oxygen than the compound that ends in ate. So, in fact, that keeps coming up here, so I'll write that down as a note. Ions that end in ite have one less oxygen than ions that end in ate. And that ends up being true of some of these other groups of ions, but I'm noticing that in your text, it doesn't make you memorize a lot of other ones. So the only ones we're going to see right now are, where we see this difference in names, are for nitrate and nitrite. Now, the other really common ones, sulfur combines with oxygen to make sulfate, and phosphorus also combines with oxygen to make phosphate. Even though you don't have to learn them, there is sulfite, which is SO3 minus 2. There is phosphite, which is PO3 minus 3. Now, why is it that the sulfur ion is negative 2? Why is it that the phosphorus ion is negative 3? Again, we're going to be able to use structures later on to justify it. But as I'm probably going to repeat over and over, for right now, you're just going to have to memorize some of these. Now, some other really common ones. CO3 minus 2 is carbonate. Now, hydrogen. What kind of ion would you think hydrogen would normally make? Instead of a compound, just an ion alone. But we'll come back to that name later on. Well, hydrogen's on the first column of the periodic table, and it normally would lose an electron. So normally hydrogen ends up being plus 1 if it ends up being an ion. So the reason I'm mentioning that is you can combine hydrogen with carbonate, and you end up with hydrogen carbonate. It has an older name that you'll still see a lot, which is bicarbonate. So the more modern, the more systematic way to call it is hydrogen carbonate, but and I think that is how, yes. Well, that is how your text names it, but your text does also mention that it's called bicarbonate. Now let's get some of these other ones. So just the same way, if you take phosphate and stick a hydrogen on it, notice that the charge goes up by 1. Phosphate itself is negative 3, but since hydrogen is plus 1 on its own, if we combine it with phosphate, that combination ends up only being negative 2. And this is called hydrogen phosphate. And there's one more version where we can stick yet another hydrogen on it, and that becomes dihydrogen phosphate. The di means 2. So 2 hydrogens stuck to a phosphate. The other ones that you need to know for now, the subject of a lot of murder mysteries, cyanide. It's a combination of carbon and nitrogen, single negative charge. Oxygen and hydrogen together, that's hydroxide, which is a shortening of hydrogen oxide. We almost never write it that way, though. We write it this way, hydroxide. Chromium. So there are 2 chromium ions you need to know. One that's called chromate. That's another one of these oxygen-containing ions. And then if you stick 2 chromates together, they end up sharing an oxygen. So we don't just double all the elements. We've got 1 less oxygen because it ends up getting shared. And this has the special name dichromate. Just a couple of more here. Manganese forms an ion that shows up in the lab a lot called permanganate. So that prefix per happens to mean that there's extra oxygen. So there's a manganate ion that only has 3 oxygens in it, and per is the signal that this one has 4 oxygens. Just a couple of more. This one can be written several different ways, so I'm going to write some of the possible formulas. One way is C2H3O2-. Another way is CH3CO2-. Another way is CH3COO-. Why are there these different ways of writing this formula? When we get to writing Lewis structures later on this lecture, I can explain why the formula is written multiple ways. Essentially, what these other alternate ways are doing is trying to show in the formula itself something about the structure of the substance, that there's a carbon that's connected to three hydrogens, there's a separate carbon that's connected just to the oxygens, and the two carbons are connected to each other. This is the ion acetate, which comes from acetic acid, which is the substance that gives vinegar its flavor and its smell. So let me just double check the list here. We got everything we need for the moment. There's a couple others that I'm leaving out for now, just because they're not going to come up as commonly. But I want to point out that everything on the page so far are anions. Most of the common polyatomic ions are anions. There's one exception, which is NH4 positive, which is ammonium. Now, I've got to point out that the neutral compound, NH3, is called ammonia. So if you see ammonia ending in A, that's a neutral substance. That IUM ending is a common ending, meaning something positively charged. So ammonium is the ion that has an extra hydrogen. So this is the list of polyatomic ions that you'll need to memorize. And like I said, you will want to start today, especially if memorization is something that takes you a while. Now, before we get to our break, let's talk about how to name compounds that contain polyatomic ions. So I'll say names and formulas of compounds with polyatomic ions. The principle is the same as what we learned with monatomic ions, in that we have to balance out charge. So let's say that I have something like magnesium nitrate. So we'll do this step by step, where I'll show just the ions first, and then I'll put the ions together. Let me emphasize again, when I'm writing just the ions, yes, we put the charges. When I'm doing the name of the actual substance or the formula for the substance, we don't put the charges in. So magnesium, that came up earlier in the lecture. We already know that's a +2 charge. Nitrate, that's one you just have to memorize for right now, that it's a -1 charge. So that means we're going to need two nitrates to go with each magnesium. So here's the way that we write that out. Because nitrate is a polyatomic ion, if you have more than one of that ion, you put it in parentheses, and then you show how many you have by putting the number outside the parentheses. So let me write that out as a note. If there is more than one of a specific polyatomic ion in a compound. That ion is written with parentheses. When writing the full formula, so we don't say N2O6 more specifically. We show the nitrate so that you can recognize it as nitrate. Now, what if you only have one of a particular polyatomic ion? Then you don't need to use parentheses. So very common substance, ammonium chloride. So ammonium, that's the one that's the cation, not the neutral substance. So it's NH4+. Chloride with the IDE, we know that's going to be minus, and it's minus one because of where chlorine shows up on the periodic table. So if we put the two together, it's NH4Cl. You don't need any parentheses on it because ammonium, there's only one of it. So for the chemist, it's obvious that it's just one unit of ammonium that's with that one chloride. Now, some other examples. Let's say that we had aluminum hydrogen phosphate. So aluminum is plus 3, like we've seen earlier. Hydrogen phosphate is a negative 2 charge ion. So it's not a term I like using because it's not exactly what we're doing. But if you've heard the phrase cross-multiply in one of your math classes before, where you take the numbers and swap their positions, that's essentially what you're doing here. That we're going to take the plus 3 in the aluminum and we're going to make that how many of the hydrogen phosphates we have. We're going to take the negative 2 on the hydrogen phosphate and move it down here with the aluminum. And the reason we do that is because that's going to make charge balance out. Because again, if we have two aluminums, that makes a total of plus 6. If we have 3 of the hydrogen phosphates, which notice that whole formula for hydrogen phosphate goes inside the parentheses. If we have 3 of them, that gives us a total of negative 6. So plus 6, minus 6, those charges balance out. Maybe just one more quick example here. Let's say that we have what have we not done yet? Calcium dichromate. So calcium, it's plus 2 because of where it is on the table. Dichromate, that's Cr2O7, and it's a minus 2 charge. When we put them together, we drop the charges. And here, this is why I wanted to do this example. Notice we only take one of each of the ions. So the reason I'm pointing this out is you might be tempted to do this cross-multiply thing like I said before, where you take the 2 in calcium and move it over here for the dichromate, the negative 2 in dichromate and move it over here for the calcium. But there's no need to do that because it only takes one dichromate to balance out with one calcium. So this is an exception to that trend of where we take the numbers and swap them. So if you end up with a situation like this, where just taking one of each ion balances the charge, then that's all we need to do. Because molecular formulas for ionic compounds, they have to balance charge, but we also try to represent them in as simple a formula as possible. So I know this is, for some of you, not the most interesting of topics, but this is the fundamental language of chemistry, names of compounds and ions. So it's something that we have to go through. So now we've gotten through the ionic compounds. There is a naming system for non-ionic compounds. But let me see if we remember, how can we tell if we have a compound that's going to be ionic, what does that normally involve? What types of elements would normally combine to make ionic compounds? So I don't know if you can recall from last week, but we talked about this property of elements known as electronegativity. So imagine that you have two atoms that form some type of bond. Last week we talked about covalent bonds and ionic bonds. Ionic bonds are ones where electrons are transferred from one element to another, and then those elements end up being attracted to each other due to charge. Covalent bonds are where electrons are shared between the elements. So why would sometimes elements share the electrons versus why would sometimes they be transferred? Well, it has to it depends on how badly atoms want to pull on the electrons between them. And that's what electronegativity is. Electronegativity is the ability of an element or an atom to pull electrons towards itself when it's part of a bond. So if you had two oxygens, for example, combining together, since they're both the same element, they're both going to pull on electrons in the same way, and so they're going to end up sharing and making a covalent bond. And so if you put nitrogen and oxygen together, that's going to be a non-ionic substance because they're close to each other. They're similar in electronegativity. Elements on opposite sides of the periodic table are very different in electronegativity. The right-hand side is very high because they want to get towards octets, and the left-hand side is low because they tend to lose electrons. And so if you take sodium and chlorine, opposite sides of the periodic table, well, those combinations are what generate ionic compounds. So it's elements on opposite sides of the periodic table that have very different electronegativity that tend to make ionic compounds. The reason this matters is if I just give you a random formula, you got to know which system of naming to use. Are we going to name it as an ionic compound or a covalent compound? And so all the diatomic examples we saw in the earlier notes, those were all elements on opposite sides of the periodic table. For these polyatomic ions, if you see a polyatomic ion in the formula, you automatically know that's an ionic substance. But now let's briefly go over the covalent names. And there's a reason that covalent compounds have a separate naming system. If naming is not your thing, then you probably don't like the idea there's multiple systems. Yes? Yeah. No, co just means the fact that however many electrons there are being shared between the two atoms. Yes. So the reason that the naming system's different for covalent compounds is you can't predict how many elements are going to react with each other. Because if it's not ions interacting, then that means there's all different possible combinations that you can end up with. For example, nitrogen can form several different compounds with oxygen. There's the nitrate ion, that's NO3-, but this is a neutral substance, N2O4. But nitrogen can also form other compounds with oxygen. So when we name these kinds of covalent compounds, that's why we use this alternate system. Just to emphasize, how do I know this is going to end up being covalent? Because oxygen and nitrogen are right next door to each other on the periodic table, and so they're going to tend to form covalent bonds. And so let me just show you the name that you end up with in this case. This is going to be called dinitrogen tetraoxide. So in these covalent names, the first element is named like it was a cation. The second element is named like it was an anion, even if there aren't any cations or anions involved. So in covalent names, The first element is named like a cation, and the second element like an anion. Since in covalent compounds, there's no pattern to how many atoms are going to be present, we use prefixes to show how many atoms are there. So covalent names use numerical prefixes to specify how many of each element is present. There's one exception to that. The first element, if there's only one of it, the prefix is left out. So as an example of that, SO3, not an ion, which we can tell because there's no charge written there. So this is called sulfur trioxide. The prefix you would use for one is mono. And in fact, let me list out the prefixes. So the prefixes are mono, di, tri, tetra, penta, hexa, hepta, octa, nona, deca. They're derived originally from Greek numerals, which you don't need to know the originals at all. And yes, this might be a random set of prefixes that you're learning, but these are used all across in naming of compounds. So it's another little bit of memorization, unfortunately, that you'll need to do. So on Thursday, maybe we'll do a little more practice once you've had a chance to go home and practice on your own. But we've now wrapped up everything related to naming compounds for the day. So now it looks like it's break time, and we'll come back to talk more about polyatomic ions and structures. Before we do move on to our next topic, there was a question that came up during the break that I wanted to share with the whole class because it's a good question. So someone asked, well, what about nitrate? Since nitrate is made up of nitrogen and oxygen that are right next to each other on the periodic table, how come it ends up an ionic substance? Well, nitrate is an ion, but that's only because in order to achieve octets, it ends up with an extra electron. It's just the way that it tends to form. But the connections between nitrogen and oxygen within nitrate are covalent bonds. So even though it may sound a little confusing, nitrate is a covalent substance that is an ion and will tend to form ionic compounds with cations. So it's still something that's covalent. But because it's an ion on its own, that's why it's named a different way. That's why it's not named with this nomenclature system that we did last. So that's true also of sulfate, phosphate, and most of those other polyatomic ions, that most of them tend to be covalent, but they're ions. And so that's why they're named in a different way. So I just want to address that because that was a good question. Now I want to return to something that we started last week, which is how to write down the structures of covalent compounds, and that's by using Lewis dot structures. So I'm not going to write the full list of rules again because I've already done that previously, but what we're going to do is a few examples of drawing the structures, and I'm going to walk through the rules because this is another one of those things that needs a little bit of practice. Now, whenever you're given a formula for something, if it's a simple ion like nitrate, the first element listed is usually the center element in a compound, and then the other elements listed usually surround that ion. So let's take an easy example like the ammonium ion. So first thing we need to do is figure out how many electrons we have to play with. So that means we need to come up with a total number of valence electrons. Well, how are we going to do that? We use electron configuration, so we look at the position on the periodic table. So nitrogen, if we count over, it's number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth column in the main group elements. So each nitrogen is going to have 5 valence electrons. Now hydrogen, we've got 4 of them, and each one has only got 1 valence electron, because hydrogen only has 1 electron. What are we going to do about the fact that this ion is positively charged? Are we going to add an electron or subtract one? Subtract. Why are we subtracting because of the positive charge? Well, because the only reason you end up with a positive charge is if it's missing an electron. So if you add up all the electrons from nitrogen and hydrogen to get this positively charged ion, we take away an electron. And so that means we end up with 8 electrons total. Now the next thing we have to do is we have to know how are the atoms connected to each other. And that's why I made that comment that in a simple substance like this, the usual case is that the first element listed is in the center, and then the other atoms are located around it. So if and when you get a problem like this, if I don't give you any clues, that's what you're automatically going to assume. Now, for slightly more complicated molecules, I would need to give you some hint to say how are the atoms arranged. And there's one specific example like that I'll do a little bit later. So first thing we do is figure out how are the elements or the atoms arranged. So the hydrogens aren't connected to each other at all. They're only connected to that central nitrogen. Does anybody remember what the next step is to draw the structure? We have to draw in bonds. Single bonds connect the atoms. Because if you don't have any bonds, well, then you don't have any way to hold the molecule together. And so once we do that, how many electrons have we used up? All 8 of them. Because remember, a bond is a pair of electrons. So this is the structure for ammonium. And what your text does is it shows that the plus charge is somewhere on the molecule by using this set of brackets. Now, once we've had a little practice, we might learn how to draw out where the individual charges are within a molecule structure. But that's something that's sort of skimmed over at the moment. So we won't do that today. We'll just focus on being able to draw the structures out. So this example is one of the simplest examples there is. So let's take one that's a little trickier. The neutral molecule carbon dioxide. So let's figure out the number of valence electrons. So carbon, based on where it is in the periodic table, how many valence electrons will it have? 4. That's right. And oxygen, we have two of them, and it's in the sixth main group column, so it's going to have six valence electrons. This is, again, why we even learned about electron configuration, so we could know how many valence electrons there would be around. So 2 times 6 is 12 plus 4 gives us a total of 16 electrons. Carbon dioxide is exactly one of those substances where the carbon will be in the center and then the two oxygens will be located around it. Just like before, the next step is to write single bonds because, again, without bonds, we don't have a molecule. What's the next step? Because for ammonium, we were done at this point. Yeah? That's right. We're going to put electrons around the remaining elements, and we're going to start with the more electronegative elements first. And that's because if an element's more electronegative, it wants to pull electrons towards itself. So we're going to follow the octet rule when we do that, which means we have the ability to put six electrons around each of the oxygens. Because remember that the bond counts as two electrons, and even though it's shared, it counts towards the octets on any of the atoms it's connected to. So for carbon, that means it currently has four electrons around it, and each of the oxygens will have an octet. But that means we're not quite done, because it wouldn't be favorable for carbon to be missing that octet. So what's the next thing that we do? We move electrons how? And how are we going to do that? Like, where are we going to put them? That's exactly right. We're going to make another bond, another connection between atoms. So what we'll do is we'll take one of these pairs of electrons and move them into between the oxygen and carbon. And we're going to do that for both sides of the molecule. Why? Well, because carbon only has four electrons around it. And if we take one pair of electrons from each side of the compound, that will end up giving us an octet around carbon. So carbon dioxide, slightly more complicated. Let's do another example of a little bit larger molecule. So this is acetic acid, which I mentioned a little while ago is the active component in vinegar. Acetic acid, you wouldn't necessarily be able to know from the structure, but its arrangement of atoms is like this. There's one carbon that has three hydrogens that are attached to it. It's connected to another carbon. That carbon is connected to two oxygens, and one of the oxygens has a hydrogen on it. So if you look at the arrangement of atoms, that helps to explain why I wrote the formula the way that I did. One of the other ways to write that molecular formula is just C2H4O2, simply to name out the type of elements and how many of each one is present. But this is very frequently done, like I said, to give some idea of what the structure of the substance is. So now, same thing we're going to do. We're going to come up with a number of valence electrons. So we have two carbons. Each one would have four valence electrons. We've got two oxygens. Each one would have six. And we have four hydrogens. Each one would have one. So 2 times 4 is 8. 2 times 6 is 12. Plus 8 gives us 20. And then we have four more from hydrogen, so that gives us a total of 24 valence electrons. What we're going to do next is write in single bonds. And this is why I showed you how the atoms are arranged, so we know which atoms to connect. Now, if we count up, we've used up 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 of the electrons. So we have to put some more electrons on here. Oxygen is more electronegative than carbon or hydrogen. And we know that because oxygen's on the right-hand side of the periodic table. So we'll put them around the oxygens first. And let's see, how many did I say we have? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 2, 4. So that fills up all 24 of the electrons. Now, notice what we have in this case. We've got carbon missing an octet. So what we'll do is we'll take the oxygen that has three pairs of electrons available, and we'll move those into a double bond. Yes?
How would you know if the double bond would go with the oxygen connected
to just a carbon? So that's one of those things I want to show on Thursday, because like I mentioned, your text doesn't really get into how do we know what the charge on each individual atom is going to be. The answer to how to know which one to do would be to know what the charge is that you end up with. So you've got a perfectly valid question, which we'll come back to on Thursday. So for right now, I'll show you that this is the formula for acetic acid. So there's plenty of practice problems. It's another one of those things I strongly recommend that you start getting working on, because there will be Lewis dot structures on the exam. Does anybody have any questions about the process for making Lewis dot structures? Again, her last question of how do we know which lone pair to move, that's a perfectly good question that we'll get to on Thursday. Yeah. Yes, it is. And you might notice I'm not writing it on the left or right. I've got it kind of slanted. And that's for reasons that we're just about to talk about. Why? What kind of shapes do molecules make? So that's our next major topic. Anyone else have any questions? Yeah.
Sorry, one more. Yeah. Is there a reason why the other two electrons aren't paired together on that same oxygen?
Why? Sorry, which one? Oh, or where on this one?
On the one you're just pointing at.
This one?
Yeah, there's two on the top right, and one on the left.
So actually imagine that you've got a triangle, that you've got a pair that's slanted, another pair that's slanted. So and the reason is because the shape that's going to tend to form. Now, you just reminded me, though, before I move on to shape, there's one other situation I got to talk about, which is that it is possible to end up with substances that won't have octets. So your book specifically goes over the example of NO2. Now, this is not NO2 minus, not nitrite. This is nitrogen dioxide. And let's follow the rules for writing up the Lewis dot structure. It's going to have just the two oxygens around it with nitrogen in the center. If we count out the number of valence electrons, that one nitrogen has 5, each oxygen has 6, 2 times 6 is 12 plus 5 gives us 17 electrons. If we make the single bonds with oxygen, that uses up 4 of them, so we can put a few more electrons around. We got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. We're going to put one electron around nitrogen. So either one of the oxygens, we can take one of those lone pairs and move it into nitrogen. And again, it will seem confusing at first. How did I choose one oxygen versus another? This one has a simpler story, but again, I will go over that on Thursday because I want to make sure I start talking about shapes today. The reason we can't move two lone pairs into making bonds is nitrogen cannot have more than 8 electrons around it. And so the way that I've drawn it right now, it has 7 electrons around it. If I tried to scoot another pair in here, that would give it 9, which would violate this octet rule. But this means that no matter what we do, nitrogen is not going to end up with an octet. This is exactly why nitrite, the ion, has a single negative charge, because if something gave another electron to nitrogen, that would give it an octet. So if you write out nitrogen dioxide, its structure, we can see from the structure it needs one more electron, which is how we could know from the structure that nitrite normally ends up a negative one ion. Now, the point of writing the structure out, though, is to say that these kinds of molecules can exist, but they tend to be particularly reactive. And so this is what is known as a free radical. Free radicals are molecules that have single, which means unpaired, electrons. You notice in all the other structures we've written so far, they're all pairs of electrons. And I use the term, and I haven't defined it yet, you could say lone electrons for the electrons that are just around an individual atom, or we could say bonding electrons for the electrons that are shared between atoms. So a free radical is where you end up with a single electron, something that's not paired up somehow. And the point of mentioning that is radicals tend to be particularly reactive. If you've taken any health or biology classes, you might have heard of free radicals before. It's part of, to go on a slight tangent, it's part of the reason that sunlight can be so damaging. Because when sunlight hits the skin, it can cause free radicals to be produced, which that could end up having consequences. So that's the purpose of me showing this example, just to show what a radical is. Yeah. Yes, so the question was, does that mean that radicals want to react in some way to end up with an octet? And the answer is yes. But what can happen is, depending on what they react with, they can cause another radical to be produced. So imagine that you have some biologically active molecule that some radical bumps into. That could end up stealing an electron away from that molecule, which might cause it to have a different behavior, because now it has a different number of electrons. So I'm simplifying, but that's one of the reasons that radicals can end up being harmful. They're reacting with anything practically, yes, to fill up that octet. So with a little bit amount of time left, I want to start talking about shapes of molecules. And to give some justification why we're talking about this, I've got to step into biology just for a second. Because does anybody know what an enzyme is? Yes, what's an enzyme? No, someone else. Yeah.
It's a chemical compound specifically made to break down other chemical compounds.
Okay, so it's some kind of substance that performs some specialized chemical reaction. And the way or the reason it has this ability is because of the unique shape that an enzyme forms. Enzymes tend to be quite large molecules. One thing about enzymes, though, is they tend to have pockets or portions of the structure that will only accept particular molecules. So if you have, there's a type of molecule called an ester. Maybe a particular enzyme is designed to break down an ester. Well, only that particular ester, if it fits in the shape of the enzyme, will it be able to react. And so biologically, a lot of reactions only happen if molecules fit the right shapes. Another example of that is in neurotransmitters. And I don't know if any of you have ever learned this at all, but when you have connections between nerve cells, that connection isn't actually a direct physical connection. There's a gap, which is what is known as a synapse. And what happens on opposite sides of that synapse is that you have a chemical messenger that's released. So one cell will release a set of chemicals that gets recognized by the other cell. Well, only if those particular chemicals fit the shapes of what are called receptor sites do you get some kind of response. Now, as a side story, that's why, for example, quitting smoking ends up being such a tough thing to do, because nicotine itself is one of these neurotransmitters. So imagine your body gets used to a certain chemical level of nicotine from smoking, and you suddenly try to stop smoking. Well, this chemical signaling agent, suddenly the body has a lower level of it, and the body doesn't like it. It goes into a form of withdrawal. So if you've ever known anybody that's tried to quit smoking, a lot of times they may end up being somewhat irritable, and that's because you're messing with this neurotransmitter level. So I know I went a little bit on a tangent, but the point is, shapes of molecules biologically end up being really important. So that's why we're going to learn the shapes of very simple molecules. And the theory that's used to predict the shapes that are going to form is called valence shell electron pair repulsion, which is abbreviated VSEPR, and it's pronounced VSEPR. So VSEPR theory, which it sounds like a mouthful, but let me break this down for us. I'm going to divide this up into three different bits here. So the first of these is the valence shell part. What's it so special about the valence shell? Well, the valence shell is the outer shell of an atom, which has the electrons that are furthest away from the nucleus, which means it has the electrons that are the most energetic. And so it's valence shell electrons that are the ones that undergo bonding. That's why when we drew these Lewis dot structures, we weren't worried about all of the electrons that are there in the atom. We're only worried about the ones in the outer shell. So the valence electrons are the electrons that participate in bonding and therefore will affect the shape of a molecule. Now, what about electron pairs? Well, whether electrons end up being lone electrons, which means they're not part of bonds, or whether they end up in bonding electrons, they tend to come in pairs. The exception being if we have free radicals, but I'll also mention that free radicals tend to be very reactive. So electrons normally occupy atoms in pairs, lone or bonding pairs. And then repulsion. What's that about? Well, electrons are all negatively charged. So one question that may come up, which I won't answer today, but just to make you think a little bit, okay, if electrons normally come in pairs, well, why would they come in pairs if they're both negatively charged? There is an answer for that that we'll get a bit later. But let's say that we ignore that part. Let's say that we can handle the fact that electrons normally come in pairs. Well, when you bring these pairs of electrons together, they are like charges, and so they want to repel each other, and they want to get as far away from each other as possible to end up as low as energy as possible. That's a general principle in nature, that systems try to go towards lowest energy. So, like charged electrons attempt to get as far away from each other as possible to minimize energy. They repel each other. So with that logic, let me show you a few simple molecules and talk about their shapes. So one of the simplest examples is the molecule beryllium hydride. If we draw out the structure of beryllium hydride, well, it's an interesting example because it's another molecule that won't be able to have an octet. And that's simply because beryllium doesn't have that many electrons to begin with. So it may be a reactive substance, but it is a substance that can be created. Now, if it's only got these two pairs of electrons in it, if it's only got these two bonds in it, how far apart could we get these bonds from each other in three-dimensional space? What kind of angle is going to form between them? Well, just the way that I'm holding my arms out, 180 degrees. Because if you get any closer than 180 degrees, that means you've got more repulsion going on. So minimum repulsion is if they're pointed in exactly opposite directions. So the bond angle here will be 180. And there's a shape name that we use to describe this, which is pretty logical. It's called linear. And it's one of the five essential shapes that you're going to need to know. Is it five or four? Five. So let's tackle another molecule. BH3, which happens to have the name borane from boron. This is a substance that's used a lot in what's called organic chemistry. Organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon-based compounds. It's awfully reactive stuff because, like the beryllium hydride, it lacks an octet on the boron. So I've never seen this done, but I've been told that if you take borane, put it in a syringe, and squirt it out of the syringe, you basically have a flamethrower because of how violently and how quickly the borane reacts with water and oxygen and other things with electrons in the open atmosphere. So borane, if it has only those three bonds in it, what kind of geometry are we going to end up with? What kind of bond angle would we have between the different boron-hydrogen bonds? 120 degrees. The way he came up with that is if you realize that a circle is 360 degrees, and if this is going to be broken up into three equal bits, because the bonds are going to be equally spaced or try to get equally spaced from each other, we divide a circle into threes, and that gives us 120 degrees. Now, It's triangular looking, but it's not really a triangle. Because to be a triangle, you'd have to connect the hydrogens to make a three-sided figure. So the term that we use is not triangular. We have another geometric term that means it's got this threefold symmetry. And the term for that is trigonal. Now, there's several trigonal shapes. We're going to see one of the other trigonal shapes later. So the word trigonal ends up not being good enough. We got to describe it a little more. Well, in three-dimensional space, it is the most favorable for these things to get 120 degrees apart, which means they're all going to lie flat in the same plane. So this is what's known as trigonal planar. Again, the reason we need that other term is there's going to be other molecule shapes that have this threefold symmetry to it. But we'll get to that in just a moment. Now, one of the last simple molecules is CH4, which that's a common enough molecule, I'm going to write its name down. That's methane, swamp gas. On paper, if we write its Lewis dot structure, it'll look like this, which is a misleading picture of what the structure really looks like. Because based off the way I just drew it, what would you guess that the bond angle here would be? 90 degrees, because if you took a circle and divided it up into four, 360 divided by four is 90. The only problem is, in this diagram, we're limiting ourselves to two dimensions. But this is really a three-dimensional shape. And so if you take that three-dimension shape into account, it actually forms a type of pyramid. And there is a way this is sometimes written to help show the fact that it's a 3D structure. Now, the way that I'm drawing these lines, you're not going to have to do. Like I said, I'm just showing you the way that it's sometimes done to highlight it's a 3D structure. This is using what's called dash wedge convention. So this thick wedge, that's trying to show that that hydrogen's pointed out towards you. The dash is trying to show that it's the hydrogen's pointed away from us. And so that's what helps give that shape its three-dimensionality. Now, suppose that I imagined that I drew lines in between all the hydrogens. Then we end up with a pyramid type of shape. But it's not any old pyramid. It's a special kind of pyramid where all the sides, angles, everything about it is totally symmetric. Which in geometry, that's a type of shape known as a hedron, which there are five main hedra. This is one of them. It's a four-sided hedron, so it's called a tetrahedron. So the shape name is tetrahedral, which you're not going to have to explain the story of where the word comes from, but I'm just trying to explain what this word means. It's a four-sided figure where every side of the figure is exactly identical. Now, I've got just enough time to introduce one more shape, and that will be for the molecule ammonia. Now, if we write out the Lewis dot structure for ammonia, you end up with something like this, where now we have three bonds, but we have a lone pair. It turns out that that lone pair distorts the geometry a little bit because it has no positive charge on the other side, so that lone pair effectively takes up a bit more room, which I just realized I skipped over something. This bond angle in tetrahedral geometry, this is 109.5. It's a number that you could derive from geometry if we really wanted to go through some painful geometry. But that's the angle we get for a perfect tetrahedron. Now, if we look at ammonia, it's going to have somewhat the same shape as methane. But like I said, the lone pair has a bit more repulsive force to it than a bonding pair. In fact, this is important enough, I'm going to write it out. Lone pairs effectively have more repulsion than bonding pairs of electrons. So lone pairs distort molecular geometry. So this is no longer going to be a perfect tetrahedron. And this is one of our other trigonal shapes. It's trigonal because it's got this threefold symmetry to it, and it's called trigonal pyramidal because it is kind of in the shape of a pyramid. It's just not a perfect pyramid like a tetrahedron. Now, I've totally run out of time, so I'll have to continue this topic next lecture. So next lecture, we will finish up chapter 4. We may backtrack to some of the small bits that I skipped in chapter 3. We will do a review of the exam material, what's coming up on the exam as well.